Our next speaker, just following the panel, is, of course, Mary Watanabe, the Acting Chief Deputy Director of the Department of Managed Healthcare. And as I was talking with Mary in the green room over here earlier, it is probably one of the busiest times at the department, which I'll let Mary elaborate on. But a lot of things happening, and we appreciate the department's willingness to come out and be with us and share their update every year. It is always extremely helpful. So with that, Mary Watanabe.
Hey, well, good morning again. As Mike said, it has been an incredibly busy year, an exciting year, and I'll show you our org chart to show you why it's been particularly busy for me. But it has definitely been a year of transition, too. We have had, a new governor, Governor Newsom, who has made healthcare a priority. We also have a new Health and Human Services Secretary, Dr. Mark Galley, who is also very passionate about healthcare and improving access to care for all Californians. So it has been a very busy year for us, and I'm going to walk you through some of the things that are going on at the department. I always like to start with our mission statement. If by some chance you don't know who we are the regulator in California for about 96% of the health consumers enrolled in health plans in California. But our mission is to protect consumer health care rights and ensure a stable health care delivery system. And so anytime I'm asked about where the department stands on something or what are we doing or what are we looking at, really looking at protecting consumers, ensuring they have access to care is always at the forefront. While also being mindful of our healthcare delivery system and the impact there and the impact of costs are a huge issue. So I just wanted to share that with you. This is our org chart. You will see there are some yellow boxes. I keep saying there's a lot of acting going on at the department. I've also been asked quite a bit if Shelley is still at the department, so Shelley Roulard is still our director. For anybody that's wondering, I am currently our acting chief deputy director. Marta Green has left the department. She went on family leave for about 6 months, and she came back for a couple days, and now she's moved on to another department. So I'm continuing in the acting chief deputy role. Filling in behind me in the health policy and stakeholder relations position is Sarah Durston. If you haven't met her, hopefully you'll get a chance to connect with her, but she's doing a great job there. Gabriel Ravel, as many of you know, has gone on to the Health and Human Services Agency, and so Sarah Rehm has been continuing to fill in as our acting general counsel, and then Fook Nguyen is filling in behind her in our Office of Plan Licensing. So we have an amazing leadership team, and I really appreciate the way that everybody has stepped up to make my life easier in an acting role, but also to fill in behind all of these other vacancies. We're hoping that as we head into the new year that there's some stability and we get to kind of have some permanent placement of our folks in these positions. So this is just our graphic from our annual report. This is actually from 2018. But I'll just point you to a couple of statistics there, which the $26 million is a number that I get asked about and talk about a lot. We have 26 million consumers in the plans that we regulate, and I'll show you a chart that breaks out kind of commercial and government and how that splits out, but that's a lot of people and a lot of responsibility to protect those folks. We, like I said, 96% of public and health plan enrollment is regulated by the DMHC. We have a help center that we're very proud of that is really kind of our heart and soul of the department that helps consumers when they have a problem, and we've helped about 2.3 million consumers resolve an issue that they have with their health care. So you can see here our growth. In 2011, we had about 350 employees and a little over $50 million in our budget, and we have grown significantly. For 2019-20, we have authority for 482 positions, so we're getting really close to breaking that 500, and our budget's right around $91 million. We added about 30 positions last year through the budget process. Part of that was related to kind of a technical cleanup where we needed authority for some of the positions we already had. But we also had some workload increases related to our plan surveys. And so we have some new staff there just because we have more plans we're regulating. We're up to 125 plans now. We also had some legislation, so AB 2674 added a few positions related to a new requirement for us to look at trends and provider complaints. So we have a provider complaint unit where providers can complain about claims payment issues or other issues they have, and now we have a requirement to monitor trends and to review all of those. Historically, we've had this provider complaint process, but we haven't had the authority to and a requirement to review all of those. AB 315, which I'm going to talk a little bit more detail on some of my later slides, is related to pharmacy benefit management reporting. We set up a task force, there's a pilot project, and there's some other requirements, so we had some positions related to that. And then AB 595 is the last one, and that gave us some new authority related to reviewing mergers, and so I'll talk a little bit about that. But that really is the, you see kind of a pretty big jump from 1819 to 1920, and so that's related to those. So again, as I said, with 26 million consumers, it's like 26.25. We're almost evenly split between commercial and government. We're a little over 13 million on the government side, and the rest, that's commercial, and then government makes up the rest. Our commercial enrollment, just to give you some sense, there's about 9.3 million that's on the large group side, and then the rest is pretty evenly split between individual and small group with 2 million apiece. And then about 81% of the government enrollment is in Medi-Cal, the rest is Medicare. So again, that gives you kind of some sense of the authority we have. We're getting a lot of questions with the change in the administration about, you know, if you wanna make a change, where can you have the biggest bang for the buck? And so we do a lot of educating of, you know, large group, there's a lot that's negotiated with employers, but that's over 9 million. And then when you look at, you know, Medi-Cal and Medicare, you know, they have DHCS and CMS have a lot of the authority there. And then when you think about individual, it's really covered California. So there's a lot of educating that we're doing of kind of, you know, how do you break down that 26 million across the different segments? The other way that we look at this is HMO versus PPO and EPO. And so you'll see here, I think our PPO is shrinking just a tiny bit over the last few years. But we've got the bulk, a little over 10 million that are in HMO products on the commercial side. And obviously about, I'd say the majority of that is Kaiser, over 8 million, close to 9 million, I think, are in Kaiser. So again, with the changes in the administration and with our leadership at the Health and Human Services Agency, these are some of our ongoing priorities, but there's a few new ones just as a result of the change and what the administration is focusing on. I will tell you that as the governor releases his budget next year and we get more clarity on those priorities, this will probably change a little bit. But I'll dive into these in a little more detail, but most of these I think probably continued from what I've reported to you the last few years. So oversight of delegates, this is not new. If you've heard me or Shelley or anyone else at the department talk about priorities, this has been a big one for the last few years. And really, I think we had some behavior by some RBOs that raised concern about the level of oversight that plans have of their delegated entities. And again, I think as we have really dived into this issue, what has become clear is it's all delegates. It's not just medical groups. And really, when we think about delegation, what functions are the plans delegating externally for compliance with the Knox-Keene Act, and what level of oversight do they have? So this is administrative services organizations, this is claims payment, this is PBMs, this is medical groups, and ultimately we hold the health plans accountable. There's a couple of regulations that we've promulgated or are in the process of promulgating to really address that. And the first one is our general licensure requirement, or what we call our risk reg, which I'll give you an update on that in just a minute. And then the financial solvency of RBOs and really increasing the requirements to be an RBO. For a brief period of time, was the acting deputy director for Office of Financial Review, and I was always astounded that you essentially have to have positive T&E, which sounded a little bit like if you had a bag of 100 pennies, you were good. You could come in and get registered as an RBO. And we really want to make sure that consumers are protected, and so that positive T&E is now increasing, and I'll talk a little bit about that as well. Timely access to care. I know there's a lot of you that have been living and breathing this with us the last few years. But in 2014, SB 964 set out the requirement that essentially gave the department 5 years to develop a standardized methodology and a rate of compliance. I personally have sat through many, many, many stakeholder meetings and work groups to really refine that. We had 5 years where we've updated and changed the methodology. As you all know, we have yet to have a standardized methodology. And we will also be establishing a rate of compliance in our regulation, which we need to have in place at the end of this year, or first part of next year. It also specifies what is included in the annual network review. So you all that work on this know that it's not just timely access. We also have our annual network review requirement. So we have a regulation that we have shared with many of you. Many of the plans and providers have seen this. It's very similar to what we shared with folks last year. There are some changes. I will tell you, when the full regulation comes out, it is huge. There is a document that's included that's over 100 pages. But it is now time for us to finalize that methodology and regulations. So look for that probably sometime in January. We're putting the finishing touches on it. It has to go through a couple layers of review. But that timely access regulation that we've all been working on for 5 years is finally coming out. Prescription drug cost transparency. I think this is another really big topic for the administration as well as nationally. I mean, I think this is a topic we all have been reading and thinking about for quite some time. The department had a couple of pieces of legislation that we've been tasked with implementing that are shedding some light and bringing transparency to prescription drug costs. The first one is SB 17, which required plans to report the top 25 drugs that were most frequently prescribed, most costly based on annual spending, and the highest year-over-year increase by annual spending as well. We released a report last year to share those results. I don't have my notes, so I won't read them all to you, but they are very interesting, particularly the makeup of total spending for specialty drugs and what cost-sharing consumers pay. The plans submitted their second year of data to us, and we finished our analysis and we're finalizing the report, so that report will be coming out soon. The other thing it required us to do was to hold an annual public meeting, either in San Francisco or LA. And so part of our requirement is to report on large group rates as required by SB 546, as well as to share the prescription drug cost information. We held our first meeting on the SB 17 data in March of this year, and we're targeting the end of February for the next meeting. It'll probably be here in San Francisco again. I will just point out, if you've never listened in or been to one of those meetings, they are very, very interesting. We tend to have people who work for hotels, who are plumbers, who are teachers, who are nurses, who come out and talk about the real tangible impact of increased premiums, that they are trading increases in their raises. They haven't had raises for 5 years because any bump they get goes to increased cost of premiums. It's probably the most unique meeting that I've ever facilitated where we really get to hear from real people about the impact of premiums. And prescription drug costs, some really, really heart-wrenching stories about the difficult choices people make between the high cost of their prescriptions and putting food on the table and daycare and things like that. So that meeting will be probably end of February here in San Francisco. So the other one is related to pharmacy benefit management reporting. So we convened a task force to provide information and recommendations on what information plans or their contracted PBM should be reporting to shed some light on how do pharmacy costs influence premiums, and just really kind of pull back the curtain a little bit on how PBMs work. We've had 4 meetings. I think we're done. Starting in July, our last meeting was last week on December 4th. And we had a committee that made recommendations, and I really appreciate their thoughtful approach to really looking at what do we get with SB 17 and how do we layer on some additional data elements to bring transparency. They kind of landed on a couple of buckets. The first one is kind of at the data level, so for those top 25 drugs, they made a recommendation to move to the top 100. And added additional information related to kind of costs and rebates and wholesale acquisition costs. There's a whole nother world of acronyms that I was not aware of that we're learning related to prescription drug costs, as well as information about PBM revenue and expenses, so kind of understanding what value do PBMs bring, what money's coming in, what's going out, what's left is profit. And so this recommendation will be finalized in a report that will go to the legislature in February. For those of you that may work on SB 17, don't panic. Those requirements would have to be changed through legislation. So we're not updating the template yet. We would need legislation to add those recommendations. So a lot of work continuing on prescription drug costs. There's a whole nother piece of this that's happening with the carve-out with Medi-Cal that I think some of you are living and breathing as well, but I'm not going to go into that. So behavioral health. This is a hot topic for the administration. It's something that I have been very engaged in at the department in the 4.5 years I've been there. We had a consumer provider plan agency work group where we really tried to think creatively about some solutions to tackle this, just the challenges of accessing behavioral health services. I would flag for you that this is going to continue to be a big priority. In particular, there is, I think, probably an accurate perception that if you have commercial coverage, you are not getting the same level of care for mental health and behavioral services as you would if you were in Medi-Cal. We are trying to understand why that is, and I think some of it is just as a commercial enrollee. You don't have some of those wraparound services. You don't have the community services, the assistance navigating crisis intervention. We don't have those benefits in many cases on the commercial side. So we'll really be kind of thinking collectively across the industry of how do we make sure that consumers can get behavioral health services. I think we all know the domino effect of if you can't get behavioral health services, that can lead to homelessness and other chronic conditions. So there will be some work happening there. This Surgeon General, California has a Surgeon General, Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris. If you haven't looked at her work on adverse childhood, I always want to say it's events, but it's not events. Anyways, it's adverse childhood situations that happen that lead to toxic stress and chronic conditions. There's a lot of work that she is doing that is very, very interesting, and some new guidance that's coming out around that. So there will be more stakeholder engagement around this, but I wanted to flag it for you because I think we'll be looking to the industry to help us think through how do we do a better job collectively. And we focus a lot on Medi-Cal, but I think there's a shift to focus on the commercial market also. I will just mention that I think provider directories become even more important in the commercial market because typically what happens is commercial enrollees have to go to their provider directory to figure out how to find a mental health provider. And we hear a lot about just the challenges of finding someone who's taking new patients. You make 10 phone calls and the person's not in the network anymore. They're no longer practicing. And so for someone that is in crisis that urgently needs services, it is even more important that we have good information in the provider directories. So you heard a little bit about provider directories that were a result of mergers. So I wanted to show you kind of on the screen here just all of the activity that we've had around mergers. It was a busy first year for me in 2015. The department hadn't had any mergers in probably 10 years, and all of a sudden in 2015, 2016, we had, there's actually an Anthem Cigna one that's not even there, we had four. And so we really kind of had to reinvent our process, which included public meetings. So you can see in 2015 and 16, we had what historically for us was kind of a traditional merger, a plan buying another plan. We had Blue Shield getting into the Medi-Cal market, Centene buying Health Net, Aetna and Humana, which we approved, but it didn't actually get approved at the federal level. So these were typical mergers, and then we had a little bit of a break, and then in 2018, we saw a different kind of merger. So you'll see there we have CVS and Aetna and Cigna Express Scripts, which were really kind of this merging of PBMs with health plans, which is a very, very interesting thing, and we'll see kind of that continuation in Merger 3.0, Merger Mania 3.0. And then we had Optum buying DaVita, so the merging of a health system with a provider group. And then now what we're seeing is what we initially were calling this kind of Merger Mania 2.5, because there were just a few that were trickling in, and I want to say we're up to about 8 or 9 filings when we include some of our specialized plans. But you'll see Anthem Beacon, I think, is one of the bigger one, as well as Centene and WellCare. And so now you've got kind of that behavioral health world coming into the health plan arena. So AB 595 gave us new authority to review these transactions for impact on the healthcare delivery system and anti-competitive activity. And so we have some new authority there. We are required to release a statement and hold a public meeting when we determine that these are major transactions. To date, we have not found any of these to be major transactions, either because of the financial impact or the number of enrollees. But we're anticipating continued consolidation in the market, so probably Merger Mania 4.0 on the horizon somewhere. But just wanted to flag for you, there's been a lot of activity here. And of course, with some of these large mergers, we've had what we call undertakings or conditions of our approval that we've attached. And we've really used those as an opportunity to tackle some of the big industry challenges like encounter data and provider directories, which we'll talk about encounter data here in a minute. I won't spend a lot of time on this since we had our panel this morning, but this gives you a little bit of a history of provider directories, and it's always a good reminder for me that we really started this work around the undertakings and Symphony because of the launch of the Affordable Care Act in California and the challenges that consumers were having accessing care. I was actually at Covered California doing outreach and enrollment at the time, and I was traveling across the state, and what I was hearing from community organizations and consumers was signs in providers' window that said, "I don't take Covered California." And when we dug a little deeper, many of them, in fact, were in network. They just didn't know it. So this really led to some work that we did. We did a non-routine survey of two of the larger plans. We found that about 25% of the providers in the directory were no longer practicing, not at that address. They were deceased, a lot of the stuff that we're still seeing today, which led to the requirement in Blue Shield making a significant investment. I already talked about our regulations against stakeholder process towards the end of the first quarter of next year, so watch for that with final regulations in place by January 1st of 2021. So the Encounter Data Initiative is very similar to the requirement that we had for Blue Shield on provider directories. We required through the Centene's acquisition of HealthNet for them to make a $50 million investment in improving encounter data. I will tell you that unlike provider directories, there is not kind of this clear solution. With provider directories, we always kind of envisioned this single place for providers to go, you know, provider directory in the cloud. And so it was a little bit more clear. With encounter data, we're not quite sure. And so there's some work that HealthNet is doing. We had a summit earlier this year where we convened stakeholders across the industry to really focus on making some improvement as an industry on encounter data. We have a number of work groups that are continuing around governance, data standardization, technical specifications. So there's work groups that are happening now that will lead to a summit later next year to kind of finalize the recommendations of the group. I think most of you probably know the importance of encounter data. It's so critical to understanding utilization, quality. When we think about HEDIS, it's used for premium setting. It's used for a lot of different things. And so it's very critical that we have accurate encounter data. I will tell you that when we've had some stakeholder meetings, there's been a lot of reports out about this. One of the things that is very striking, and it's very similar to provider directories, is that when you get down into the actual physician office, the staff in the office often don't even know what encounter data is. They don't understand the importance. They don't understand that if the coding's not done correctly, that has these very large ramifications. One of the things we didn't talk about a lot on the provider directory panel this morning was really the boots on the ground outreach going into offices to educate them about why it's so important to update your information about provider directories. And that same level of engagement is probably going to need to happen for encounter data because there's so much that needs to be done, and it is so critical, particularly in a heavily delegated model, that we have good encounter data. One of the other things that's happening that it's not our area of expertise, and we're kind of involved in a limited way, is the Office of Statewide Health Planning and Development is working on essentially an all-payer claims database in California. In other states where you have a lot of fee-for-service, getting claims is pretty easy. It's, you know, there's an incentive to fill it out and have accurate claims. But for California to be successful in understanding the cost and quality, we need good encounter data. And so there's a lot of work that we're doing to kind of make sure the industry is engaged and there's alignment across all of these initiatives and we don't create new fields over here for this project, but over here for the all-payer claims database, they need something different. So we're trying to make sure there's some alignment with all of those efforts. So in addition to all of that stuff that's been happening, it has been a very, very busy season for regulations, and it is not going to stop. So if you are here and you work on regulations, I'm sorry, we're going to keep you busy for the foreseeable future. We went for several years with maybe one regulation a year or no regulations, and we had a lot. So I know there's a panel coming up after me about the general licensure regulations, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time other than to say, our intent with this regulation was really to codify some terms that we all have used but have not been in regulations. Things like global risk, institutional professional risk, healthcare service plan, our process for licensing restricted Knox-Keene license plans. And so that was our intent. For those of you that are involved in regulations, you know that through the regulation process, once it was filed with the Office of Administrative Law, we made some changes to the regulation based on public comment that created a lot of anxiety and confusion and fear. And when we're in formal rulemaking, we can't talk to anybody. Everything has to be on the record. And so we were finally able to get that regulation approved, and we're able to talk to a lot of people, including our provider groups and our plans and hospitals, and I think things have settled down a little bit. We also released an all-plan letter. I want to say that went out in June or July of this year, with kind of a phased-in approach to really try to calm some of that anxiety, which is essentially requiring these entities that are taking on global risk. So the requirement was if you're taking global risk, institutional, professional, you either need a license or you need to get an exemption from the department. So we did kind of this phased-in exemption. It was kind of a file and use, and you can get an exemption that if there's a health plan involved, it will continue for the length of the contract and some other requirements. And I will tell you that when we initially were talking to everybody about doing this all-plan letter, we were told there would be thousands of applications. So we were gearing up because we don't have resources for thousands, but we were going to do our best. And so over the last 5-6 months, we've received 165 applications for an exemption. So not thousands. We're still anticipating there's going to be a flood, but it hasn't come in yet. So what I would tell you is if this impacts you or you think it might, you're not sure what you should do, call us. We have had some really good conversations with entities. We're getting smarter. Everybody we talked to had some sort of a different risk-sharing arrangement. A lot of them either had no downside risk or there was some sort of like a bonus structure with no financial withhold at the end of the contract. But everyone was a little bit different. What I keep telling everybody is we're going to get smarter. We needed to do this regulation to understand how things work. We are considering doing a regulation once we've had more of these contracts that come in and we understand kind of the landscape of how things are working. And so we're considering doing a regulation to kind of put some guardrails and some boundaries on what is okay and what would require a license and that type of thing. So again, if you have questions, concerns, this is leading you to think maybe you do need to come and get a restricted Knox-Keene license, please reach out to us. We have information on licensing on our website. I'll put up my contact information. You can always just shoot me an email and I'll connect you with the right person. So the other regulation was our risk-bearing organization requirement. The biggest change that I want to flag for you if you're part of a medical group is that the T&E requirements, there's new T&E requirements that require to apply to all RBOs, takes effect a year after the effective date of this regulation. So between now and October of next year, you need to make sure that you're able to meet those new T&E requirements. But there's also other financial reporting requirements, including giving us more oversight and visibility into the sub-delegated arrangements, because we have been seeing some very complicated sub-delegated arrangements that are so far down, there's not a lot of visibility to us or to the plans. The other one is cancellations, rescissions, and non-renewals. This really has a huge impact to notices and grace periods for those in covered California. The initial regulation that we did was very problematic. We knew this was one we needed to kind of rewrite, which we've done, and that took effect in October of this year. There's an all-plan letter that I believe has gone out with some filing requirements. If you missed the filing deadline, we'll be following up with you. The other one that we've been working on, I think almost since I've been at the department, was a standard formulary template, which requires plans to post the template, the formulary online, and there's a standard template for that, and I think we just sent out an all-plan letter with additional guidance on that. And for those of you that are not regulated by us and you're hearing all this all-plan letter stuff, we do have them published on our website. So what's in the queue? I've talked a little bit about the timely access methodology, so that'll be coming out. SB 1008 also required us to come up with a dental matrix that'll allow consumers to kind of compare their coverage and cost sharing across different dental plans. That's coming soon. Provider directories we've already talked about. And then the last one is out-of-pocket maximum tracking. We had an agreement to work on a regulation that would allow consumers in real time, ideally, to see where they are in meeting their out-of-pocket maximum and deductible. We know we don't currently have the systems in place to do that in real time. I think things like an all-payer claims database will help that, but we're working on a regulation that'll be coming out next year on that. Okay, and there's more. Prescription drug tiering, I think I've been saying this one for about 3 years. We're serious this time, it's really coming. This is really around how drugs are placed on the tiers and how you have to have at least one drug in a certain tier. So more information on that. We have been working with a consultant. Pharmacy is not our in-house area of expertise. We're a department about a quarter attorneys. But we have a consultant that's advising on that. So that should probably come out this year at some point. The other one that I've been saying is coming, that every year we add another bill to, is on the rate templates. So we need to put into regulation our templates for large group rates and the prescription drug costs. I will tell you that AB 731 on large group rates will probably get tagged onto that this year. So this is one that may get carried into the next year. We're going to try to do everything at once in terms of codifying our rate reporting templates. We also plan to update the financial reporting requirements. I think we've shared a draft maybe with some of the plans on this, but we'll need to put our new financial reporting forms into regulations. We also have a cleanup regulation related to our help center that really just updates some of the IMR, independent medical review, and complaint processes the plans are already engaging us on that we just need to update. It's been a long time since we've updated those. So that is what is in the queue for regulations. So it's going to be another busy year, and some of this will probably carry into the next year. So in addition to being a busy regulation year, it was also a very, very busy legislative season. And it has not stopped. Our LEG staff usually get a little bit of a break kind of between October and December, and they have had no time to catch their breath. It's been very busy. We analyzed and reviewed over 50 bills, which is a lot for us. We had about 20 of those that were actually signed, which is also a lot. There is an all-plan letter that we call kind of our legislative implementation all-plan letter that will be out probably in the next week, which gives guidance on kind of compliance and filing requirements around about 16 different bills that were passed this year. So it's a large number, but I will tell you that in terms of the big lift of implementation, there aren't any really big ones like of a SB 137 level implementation, no five-year plan that we're going to be on for anything. I'll flag just a few of these, but I wanted to make sure you had on the slide what we're tracking. So AB 290 is the one that has probably kept me the busiest since it was signed, and this is really around third-party premium payments, and when those payments are made by a financially interested entity. There are a number of different phased-in dates and work that we'll be doing. I think probably the most significant is it sets a default reimbursement rate and a reporting requirement to the department. And so the piece here that so anybody who was receiving third-party premiums prior to October 1st of this year, they're grandfathered in. So I think that's an important nuance. The other thing that I will flag is the American Kidney Fund has been pretty public about saying that they are leaving California. They're one of the biggest entities that are paying premiums for consumers. We have a fact sheet on our website and information that we've shared about just trying to reach these consumers that may be losing coverage January 1st if someone's not paying their premium. So if you're interested or you're getting any calls about this, just know that we have some information on our homepage at dmhc.ca.gov or healthhelp.ca.gov. AB 577, this is just continuity of care related to mental health for maternal mental health coverage. And then AB 651, continuing on the state's efforts to protect consumers from surprise balance billing. This one applies to air ambulance providers. AB 731, I mentioned, this is our large group rate review bill. So we'll have large group rates requirements. There's a notice requirement to employers 120 days in advance of those large group rates. This takes effect, I think, July 1st of next year. There's also additional geographic regional trend information that will be filed as part of individual and small group. And then in 2021, there's a new process for individual contract holders in the large group market to request like a full review of their rates for their individual contract. So a lot of work that we'll be doing. I know this is one that's creating a lot of anxiety about what are we going to require, what's going to be in the template, what will be confidential. We are working on that. We've actually already engaged with a consultant to help advise us on that. Similar to the process that we had for SB 546, we'll have a work group to really work on refining those templates. We'll be working with the Department of Insurance and the sponsors of this bill as well. So everybody take a little bit of a breath. We know that there's some urgency to this, and we're working on guidance as well as those draft templates for you. AB 744, not a whole lot here, even though it is a big deal, establishes payment parity for telehealth services. So essentially reimbursement for telehealth services needs to be in parity with those for an in-person visit. There's some guidance that we'll be giving in our all plan letter, but we know that that has some significant impact for our health plans. AB 954 has some provision around dental contracts and leasing of networks. Again, I don't think we're going to be giving any particular guidance other than follow the law, but let us know if you need more. AB 1309, this is really a covered California bill that changes our open enrollment for next year. And so the open enrollment will be November 1st through January 30th, starting in 2020. AB 1802 was really more of a cleanup bill. The one thing that I will flag for you is it changes our website and our phone number. I think it was like there's a HMO helpline or something that was in our phone number that is a carryover from many, many years ago. So we cleaned that up. For plans who have this information in documents, we'll have you clean that up as you file ongoing. You will see us continue to use the healthhelp.ca.gov in our own marketing materials and our outreach materials, but that's probably the most significant impact of that bill. Let's see. So SB 129 has some additional reporting requirements and requirements for us to also publicize enrollment information. There's also a requirement that plans report MEWA information, multiple employer welfare arrangements, which we don't have any, but there's still an annual reporting requirement. SB 159 allows pharmacists to directly prescribe PrEP and PEP, and it removes the prior authorization step therapy requirement, which for the consumers that need access to this is actually a big deal because the prior auth was creating barriers for consumers trying to get both PrEP and PEP. The pharmacist prescribing requires some regulations from the Board of Pharmacy, and so they'll be working on that next year. Let's see, SB 260, this is another covered California bill that's going to allow for Medi-Cal consumers that are disenrolled from Medi-Cal to be enrolled in the lowest cost silver plan in Covered California. So not a whole lot of involvement for us, but I know for the plans, this is going to be a big deal, and for consumers. Let's see, SB 343 applies to one plan, and if you're in the room and you know who you are, then you're probably very aware of that bill. We also have a number of bills here that relate to Medigap, and I will warn you that Medigap is not our area of expertise, so we're going to be working to get a lot smarter on Medigap. And then the other one here, SB 600, this really just clarifies the department's existing interpretation that fertility preservation is a basic health care service under existing law, and I'm sure many of you in this room are very familiar with that one. All right. That was a lot of information. So you do have my contact information here. You are more than welcome to reach out to me if you just need to connect with somebody in the department, you have a question, that risk reg has gotten you very upset or confused, shoot me an email. If I don't reach out to you directly and respond, I will have somebody follow up with you. And that is my direct phone number as well. You're always welcome to reach out to me. So with that, I'm gonna try to go to questions. We've got microphones.
I'm Lan Pham. I'm the CEO of MSO Inc. of Southern California. I don't understand why there's still so much confusion with related to the legislation about who needs to get a restricted NOSKIN license and who doesn't. Because we spoke to a number of hospital systems that are taking full risk for health plan contracts and then sharing the surplus or the deficiency with provider group, and those hospitals don't seem to believe that they need a license.
So the hospitals seem to think that they need a license?
They don't believe.
And they're probably correct. So again, I think a very strict reading of the law is if you are accepting any global risk, you need a license or an exemption. I think part of the panic and the concern and the confusion is everybody defaulted to, we need a license. There's also an exemption process. And again, this is really why we took a very kind of conservative approach and did this phased in, and we're gonna grant an exemption. But I will tell you that I think what was really helpful for us to have calls with the hospitals, I think that really calmed them down and helped them to understand. So again, I appreciate your comment. I would just say if you have those concerns, talk to us. Our acting general counsel, Sarah Ream, probably does at least one or two phone calls almost every day with somebody concerned about this. And I don't think there's anybody that has talked to her that walked away in a panic still. In most cases, either they said, okay, we need to request an exemption, or you know, maybe we do need a license. And they've come in, we do what we call a pre-filing, which is come in and tell us what you're doing, and we'll tell you if we think you need a license. So hopefully, if you need to talk to us, please do so. Okay, I see a hand back there on the left.
Okay.
We'll get a microphone over to you in just a minute.
Good morning. My name's Robin Del Morales, and I'm with Kern Health Systems, one of the Medicaid plans. And I had a question in regards to the work groups for the encounters, mm-hmm. since we sometimes struggle with what we have to do for the DHCS versus what we have to do for DMHC. How do we get involved in the work groups in discussing what's needed or what the rules are for encounters?
Sure, so if you're not already a part of that and someone in your organization is not a part of it and you're interested, shoot me an email and I will connect you with our health net partners that are running that. I will tell you that they're working on kind of a plan to report out more broadly. There will be kind of this follow-up summit, but the plan is really to engage broadly across the industry with the findings and next steps. So they'll be making a recommendation essentially about how to invest the remaining of $50 million to really make an improvement in encounter data. So shoot me an email. You've got my contact information up here, and I'll connect you.
All right, are there any more questions? We have a question right here to your left, Mary.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, Molly Colombo, Scan Health Plan. I'm not sure if this is out of scope, but can you talk at all about the executive order from Newsom from January of this year about pulling the pharmacy out of managed care into fee-for-service?
Oh, yeah, it is out of scope for me. And one I'm glad to say is out of scope for me because I know it is a very contentious topic. I can't. That's really under DHCS's purview, the Department of Healthcare Services that administers Medi-Cal. So there's a lot happening on it, I know, and I know the plans aren't too happy about it, but here we are.
All right, any other questions? Okay, very good. Thank you very much, Mary.
Thank you very much.